Our guest tonight is Henry Kissinger. His new book, Diplomacy, is just published by Simon & Schuster. And it is a most compelling analysis of the nature of the relations between states, of the making of policy, for that matter, of the making of bad policy as well as good, and about what drives the foreign policies of various nations or various sectors of the world. Dr. Kissinger, let me come directly to it and in essentially personal terms. January 20th, 1969 is the date when you enter the Nixon government, the newly formed Nixon government, as the head of the National Security Council. You are National Security Advisor. What was the international situation and what were the major challenges as you and President Nixon perceived them at that very moment?
When Nixon was inaugurated, we had been in the Vietnam War for 5 years. We had had 35,000 casualties. There were demonstrations in the streets of Washington, even as Nixon was inaugurated. Relations with the Soviet Union were frozen and hostile. They had just occupied Czechoslovakia the year before. There were no relations at all with China. The Arab states had all broken diplomatic relations with us in the aftermath of the Arab-Israeli War of 1967. The United States and our relations with the European nations, our NATO allies, had also deteriorated. So the foreign policy situation of the United States was complex, and one could see potentially dangerous, and we didn't have all that many apparent options, and our first desire was to increase the range of our options so that we would have some more maneuverability in our foreign policy.
As we sit here now, some 25 years, is that right? Yes, so just about 25 years after the beginning of that Nixon administration. Has the world unfolded pretty much as one might have predicted at that time? Or indeed, if you could have jumped forward for a 25-year look into the future, would you have been astonished back in 1969?
Well, I would not have expected the Soviet Union to have collapsed totally, and communism to have disappeared, and the Soviet Union dissolved into its component states. I don't know anybody of either party or any leading intellectual who argued that proposition. In those days, there were still many who believed that the Soviet Union was gaining on us in military superiority and that they might try to take over the world. In fact, were engaged in trying to take over the world. So that we would not have expected. The relations with China, we hoped, would evolve in the direction that they did. But you have to remember, when Nixon came to office, we did not have, not only did we have no diplomatic contact with them, we didn't know how to reach them. They had called back, they were engaged in the Cultural Revolution, and there were no Chinese ambassadors anywhere in the world except Egypt, with which we had no diplomatic relations. So it was technically just to find a way of contacting the Chinese.
When did those talks in Warsaw begin?
Well, there were talks in Warsaw. They began, I think, in the early 1960s or even in the late 1950s. They were very formalistic, but the Chinese ambassador in Warsaw had also been called home as a result of the Cultural Revolution. And when we came in, there were no talks in Warsaw at all.
Speaking of the Chinese, I have a quotation for you that I would love to get your reaction to. It is a play on the misquotation from Clausewitz. This is Chou En-lai speaking. All diplomacy is a continuation of war by other means.
Well, that's what the Chinese believe. For the Chinese, war and diplomacy are a seamless web, or rather power and diplomacy are a seamless web. And the American argument that now we are using only diplomacy and that no other pressures come into play is incomprehensible to the Chinese. Another thing that's incomprehensible to the Chinese is we sometimes say to them, you have to do something for us to help us in our domestic situation. Their view is our domestic situation is our problem. They will do something for us for a reciprocal benefit. They will not do anything for us in order to help us at home.
And that's very much to the forefront even this very night. That is these days.
At this very moment. I mean, the Clinton administration has the habit of saying to the Chinese, we have now started talking to you, so you've got to do something for us. Now, that is flawed on two grounds. One, the Chinese do not believe that talking to them is a favor that we extend to them. They think they're entitled to that. Every other nation does it. Secondly, when we say do something for us, there isn't a meaningful concept. Very early in my dealing with the Chinese, I was drafting a communique with Zhou Enlai. And I said, if you take out this sentence, I'll take out another sentence that you don't like. He said, if you want to take out a sentence, you give it to Nixon. I don't want it. From your side, you tell me what's wrong with my sentence. And we'll do it on its merits.
It's clear from your book that, in your view, and I'm sure this is a correct view, that different nations, by virtue of their different historical experience, their different geographical situation, their different cultures, take very different approaches to how they think about relations with other nations and what the purpose of international contact and international negotiation or diplomacy might be.
Absolutely.
You focus on two alternating or conflicting styles that have dominated American foreign policy design in, I guess, virtually all of our history. You label them as an interest in balance of power is essentially the European approach. Our approach, I was looking for the metaphor you use. America as a beacon or America as a crusader is your vocabulary. Explain that.
Exactly right. One school of thought says, both schools of thought really believe that what America does applies to the whole rest of the world. But one school of thought says, let's build up our own institutions, let's succeed at home, and let's build a society that is so exemplary that the whole rest of the world will want to imitate it.
And with that also goes a kind of isolationist position.
That leads, in effect, to an isolationist.
We won't worry about the rest of the world. We'll set them the example, and then ultimately they will have to come to us.
Exactly. They'll come to us, or they won't come to us. Yeah. But that's the best we can do. The other says, if we want peace, we have to spread democracy. That democracies don't go to war. And therefore, that develops a missionary quality. Wants to spread American values around the world. That's what we do today in some of our human rights approaches.
And the prime early exemplar of that was Woodrow Wilson.
Woodrow Wilson was the father of it.
Yeah.
And what I find so fascinating about Woodrow Wilson is that the European nations had conducted foreign policy for 300 years of a certain style, right or wrong. The United States had either not conducted foreign policy or it had sort of try to imitate the European policy starting with Theodore Roosevelt. Then Woodrow Wilson comes along and he says, everything that's gone before is nonsense. The following propositions are true. Alliances are wrong, collective security is right. Self-determination makes for peace. Democracy makes for peace.
This is
nobody
Wilson.
Said, how do you know this? What is the evidence that this is true?
This is Wilson at Versailles.
This is his Wilson 14 points.
How did the European opposite numbers that he dealt with really privately react to all of that?
Well, Clemenceau said these are marvelous ideas. except they don't apply to human beings. They were in a very difficult position. They know that without the United States, they couldn't have won the war. They knew that they needed American economic help in the post-war period, and they were also afraid that if Germany ever became strong again, they needed American support. On the other hand, they didn't know what to do with the Wilsonian ideas, because since the Treaty of Westphalia in Europe since 1648, no peace settlement in Europe had been made on the basis that Wilson was proposing. So they had absolutely no criteria on which to judge the various propositions. And one of the results of it was, before the principle of self-determination as applied by Woodrow Wilson, Germany was surrounded by big powers, Russia, Austria, France. It therefore couldn't expand without a major war. After the Treaty of Versailles, Germany was surrounded by weak powers. And even though it lost 13% of its territory as a result of losing the war, it gained in geopolitical strength by the fact that vis-à-vis Czechoslovakia, Poland, Austria, it was so far stronger. So it was only a question of time until Germany began to exercise pressure on its neighbors. And the American approach so much rejected geopolitics and strategy that that issue was never addressed.
Now, apart from the model of foreign relations, which says essentially, forget foreign relations, let's just perfect ourselves and the world will learn from our example, the Beacon model, and apart from the missionary model or the crusader model, which Wilson represents, there are various other available models. And one that one is constantly exposed to, even as an undergraduate when you take your first course in foreign relations, is the balance of power model. It is commonly believed by people half educated in these matters that balance of power is the way most states organize their foreign policy, the raison d'état, the reason of state, in which one pursues the interests of the nation, particularly against those other competing nations more or less in the neighborhood, and you reach accommodations which take into account the various needs of separate nations, and you maintain military balances, but the balance of power might easily come unglued and some trouble might ensue, so you might have to fight an occasional war to rectify and reach a new balance of power. But that model, you say, is by no means universally held by all the wise diplomats and the wise foreign ministers of the world. It has not been eternal. It is, in fact, rather specifically a product of European experience.
Europe, Greek city-state, the balance of power evolves as a system. When there is a multiplicity, a fairly large number of states of more or less equal strength, then you can build foreign policy on equilibrium. Balance of power is not something you invent. In most areas of the world, there have been empires rather than a number of states of more or less equal.
Which you say is the other great model of international organization.
That's right. The Roman Empire didn't have balance of power as a policy. It adjoined other empires, and it therefore had tests of strength with these empires, but there were no factors to be juggled. There was either war or peace. The Cold War period, we didn't have full understanding, but it was the two Cold War period. The Cold War period had two spheres of influence, or two, what you can't say imperial structures, but quasi-imperial structures impinging on each other. China has been an empire for most of its history and had not to deal with the balance of power. It's peculiar to Europe after 1648.
But a moment ago you made some mention of the Greek city-states, and of course,
and of the Italian city-states
later,
also in the 15th century.
But in the Greek cities, in the Peloponnesian War, as described by Thucydides, we already see balance of power theory as the way in which states organize
absolutely
their external relations.
That's right. Yeah. The Greek city-states attempted to maintain a rough equivalence among each other and when to war to adjust it periodically.
Except that then somebody gets hungry. One of the states that's doing rather well tends to develop larger ambitions. Indeed, Athens did develop those larger ambitions.
Yes, and then either the ambitious state succeeds in establishing an empire, or it is humbled, or they drain themselves so much that they collapse as an operating system.
And you get taken over by the Macedonians.
Exactly.
A century
or
later.
Or the Russians, or the Americans.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the world that we have inherited is a matter of immediate concern. It's interesting that you start this volume, Diplomacy, which I should have said, if I did not, is just recently published by Simon & Schuster. You start it with a chapter titled The New World Order, and you end it with a chapter titled The New World Order Reconsidered. And we have to talk about what new world order is emerging and how that gives a challenge to the patterns of American diplomacy and of American foreign policy design. So we'll return, I think, to that directly after we pause for these words. Our guest tonight is the former Secretary of State of the United States and the former National Security Advisor as well, Henry Kissinger. His new book, Diplomacy, is just published by Simon & Schuster. It's a rich book full of dexterous analysis of some 300 years of foreign policy or diplomatic history, and we can't possibly do full justice to it. And I've tended to stress the situations and the problems that face us today, and I was just setting up for that a moment ago to talk about the world we now face after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and thus in the post-Cold War era. But before we come to that, let me backtrack just a little bit. We can't do all of the history that you cover in this book, but let's plug back in at least 40 or 50 years ago with World War II. You say something quite interesting in one of the chapters in this book, and if I may, I'd like to ask you to read a few words. This is about a very distinctive figure of our time, of the 20th century, namely Adolf Hitler. And I've marked two paragraphs, one at the very beginning and one two pages later. After you read this, if you would be so kind, there's a crucial question I would like to pose.
How far do you want me to read it?
Just that very first paragraph and then a paragraph marked on the next page.
Okay. Hitler's advent to power marked one of the greatest calamities in the history of the world. But for him, the collapse of the House of Cards, which represented the Versailles International Order, might have proceeded in a peaceful, or at least in a non-catastrophic fashion. That Germany would emerge from that process as the strongest nation on the continent was inevitable. The orgy of killing and devastation that it unleashed was the work of one demonic personality. Hitler's egomania, that's the next, not the immediately following paragraph, but on the next page. Hitler's egomania had deadlier consequences as well. He had convinced himself, and what is more significant, his entourage, that because his faculties were unique, all his goals had to be accomplished in his own lifetime. Since on the basis of his family history, he had estimated that his life would be relatively short, he was never able to permit any of his successes to mature, and pushed forward according to a timetable established by his assessment of his physical powers. History offers no other example of a major war being started on the basis of a medical conjecture.
It's a fascinating point and a wonderful sentence that summarizes that point. But to me, it is representative of a larger and an eternally puzzling issue. And that's the issue of the great historical actor as a way of accounting, and his own idiosyncrasies, his own special personality qualities as he brings them to the making of policy, including the making of wars, that as opposed to an analysis which makes reference to historical forces, the unfolding of strategic considerations, economic considerations, and so on. It looks as if there can be no science of history on the basis of which one can predict, because we cannot account for the accidental entry into the historical process of certain great actors who put their own stamp on and their own control over the flow of events itself.
There can't be any science of history in that absolutely predictive sense. Although it's interesting, if one reads the philosophy of modern physics, that even in modern physics there are limits to prediction.
You're evoking Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. I'm thinking
the Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, and also the work of Stephen Hawking, according to which the Einstein theory is correct for large distances and objects, and the Heisenberg principle is accurate for the small ones, but the two don't happen to be consistent with each other. So an element of uncertainty exists even in the physical world. In the historical world, it is much greater, because actors can enter and shape it in a much briefer period of time. There is an objective environment without the weakness of the Versailles settlement, for example. Hitler could not have operated as he did. Without the German inflation, a man like that destroyed the middle class, a man like him could never have come to power. But what he would do then, coming to power, was very peculiar to him. But it's true even in America. Among the contemporaries of Lincoln that might have been president, there was none that was so dedicated to maintaining the Union and so ruthless and far-sighted in maintaining it as Lincoln. When one looks at the more recent past, among the possible American presidents in the 1930s, I can't think of one personality who could have taken the America that had passed three neutrality acts in 1937 to full collaboration with Britain in 1940, in 3 years, and into the war in 1941 as a united people.
And if you play the what...
Franklin Roosevelt did that.
And if you play the what-if game, you can come up with all sorts of wonderful provocations to wonder. What if Roosevelt had not dropped Henry Wallace as his vice president, his third term vice president, and had kept Wallace on the ticket so that Wallace ascended to the presidency after Roosevelt's death at the beginning of the fourth term? How would the Cold War have been played through?
Well, the Cold War would certainly not have started as early as it did. But Europe might have gone communist. Without Harry Truman, very likely. Not so much that the Russians would have occupied it, but that the communist parties would have won the elections in France and Italy, and then an isolated Germany with a third of its country being occupied might also have adjusted.
Jumping forward, which is quite a leap over 5 years of fascinating history, but jumping forward to the end of the war and the emergence of the Cold War, a great question, and I know you've pondered this a great deal in your scholarly years as well as in your years in office, was the Cold War inevitable? What accounts for that quick emergence of this pattern of steadfast hostility and competition involving war threat and high levels of armaments between the Soviet Union and the United States and their various allied nations on both sides? What caused the Cold War? Was it indeed inevitable, or might it have gone otherwise?
You have to look at the psychology of people involved. I believe what produced the original clash was the fact that there were two totally incompatible philosophies of international relations confronting each other in the United States and the Soviet Union, or let's say in Franklin Roosevelt and Joseph Stalin. Franklin Roosevelt was a Wilsonian. He sincerely believed that one should make peace on the basis of personal relations among the leaders, trust among the leaders, and the spreading of goodwill around the world. Joseph Stalin was a cold-blooded, paranoid, brilliant realist, and on top of it, a devout Marxist. So he could not believe that personal relations could affect the course of history. To him, the decisions of statesmen depended on what he called objective reality. He would pay no price for the goodwill of America that did not coincide with his national interest in his, as he perceived it, or his ideological interest. So, for example, in 1941, being a realist, with the Germans approaching Moscow, he nevertheless invited Eden to Moscow to discuss a settlement of the post-war period, because for him the war made no sense except in the political terms of the post-war period. Then this coincided with Pearl Harbor, so the decision was deferred. 3 months later, he sent Molotov to London in May of 1942, again to work out a settlement. The Americans, by then in the war, nearly had an apoplectic fit because they didn't want to talk about concrete political solutions. They wanted to build a post-war structure based on the so-called four policemen, Britain, the United States, China, and the Soviet Union. So Roosevelt and the Russians, the Soviets had actually made a number of proposals on what the world might look like in the post-war period. They were not modest, but they were much more modest than what finally emerged. Roosevelt invited Molotov to Washington, and he said, don't talk about these concrete things, which were the traditional things of international relations. Let's talk about four policemen. Molotov probably hardly believed his good fortune that he could get away without having to make any real concessions. And so the post-war structure was kept totally open throughout the war. This, in turn, coupled with the principle of unconditional surrender, created a vacuum which the Russians filled with their armies. So this is how it came about to begin with.
Now, you know, revisionist historians on the Western side would argue, or at least used to argue before the Cold War came to its natural end, they used to argue the Soviets needn't have gone in that direction. We scared the hell out of them by our detonation of the two nuclear weapons over Japan and by our tough line and by the Marshall policy and so on.
That's historically inaccurate because the Soviets had occupied Poland and were in the center of Germany well before the detonation of the atomic bomb. And our line wasn't all that tough at the beginning. At the beginning, we wanted to cooperate with them. The problem was, we said to them, according to Yalta, you ought to get out of Eastern Europe. I am of the view, and in fact I describe it in the book, I'm of the view that Stalin grabbed Central Europe as a bargaining chip.
Yeah.
And he was waiting for some proposition. And for him, the only proposition that made any sense was one that had analyzable consequences. Talking to him in the abstract about a legal obligation made no sense, so he stayed seated there. The only one who understood this in the immediate post-war period was Churchill.
Churchill always
wanted to force a showdown.
If you had been 25 years older than you are and were somehow in there within policy councils, at least offering advice, what advice would you offer at that point as to what to propose to Stalin?
I probably would like to think that I would have gone along with Churchill.
Mm-hmm.
Because Churchill, in effect, was saying two things. We must negotiate now, But I have the impression that in the back of his mind he also believed that if we don't negotiate, if the Russians won't negotiate, we will then give them some sort of ultimatum and become much tougher. I think there were both of these elements. I would like to think that I would have favored that.
Mm-hmm.
But once the post-war, but to answer your question about the inevitability of the Cold War, once we did not negotiate, and once the Soviets established themselves, then a pattern developed which was very hard to break. Because once NATO had been formed, for example, I always thought intellectually, as a professor, that a good opportunity existed to negotiate with the Soviets after the death of Stalin, or even around the time of the death of Stalin. But by that time, as I think about it more, NATO had been formed. The Soviets could have wrecked NATO just by the act of negotiating without ever making any concrete proposals. And probably it was prudent not to risk the cohesion of NATO for a negotiation when you didn't know the outcome.
What ensued then was some 40 years of a pattern that was labeled the Cold War, and the pursuit of a policy of détente, or rather of containment.
Of containment.
Of containment. Détente was a period within the history of containment. Containment policy supposedly was, I don't know that Kennan was the original source of it, but it was laid out.
I would say it was laid out best by
Kennan, in his famous Mr. X articles in Foreign Affairs, what years?
48.
Way back in 48. You've got a chapter on containment as such. Did containment do the trick? Do we understand the ultimate collapse of the Soviet Union and the ultimate victory in the Cold War, if victory it was, as a consequence of containment policy?
Well, first of all, containment was a very American theory. I don't think any other nation could have been in, because here we are confronted with a power which we suddenly perceive as hostile. George Kennan made a number of propositions. One, he said the hostility is inherent. It isn't caused by anything we did. It is in the nature of the system. Therefore, don't expect any change of policy until the system changes. How then do we keep the system from changing? Or how do we make it change? And the way we make it change is to contain it, to keep it from filling every crevice. Then, after a period of time, a moment will come, he said, where competition within the leadership groups will oblige them to enlist the public, and then the Soviet state will appear as a very weak state.
It was really the advice, hang tough, don't let them get away with anything, but be patient.
Be patient, but for what? This is the purely American element in it, with two components. One, it really obliged us to try to rehabilitate the whole world, because we had to man the parapets all around that huge Soviet periphery. And it wasn't enough just to do it militarily, we had to do it economically to a certain extent. No other nation has ever undertaken so ambitious a proposition. The second part was, don't worry about what happens when the Soviet system collapses, because the beneficial consequences of it will be totally self-evident and will take care of themselves. We were containing them to have a negotiation, but we never spelled out what we would do in that negotiation. And this was a policy for about 40 years.
And apparently we never fully spelled out, or even to ourselves, a vision of what the world would be like after the collapse of Soviet communist power.
No, because we thought that the world was normally peaceful. So therefore, if there was war, it was caused by evil men, or tension.
Mm-hmm.
If the evil men disappeared, you didn't have to worry about the consequences, because their disappearance was the only consequence you really needed.
And the history of the last 2 years in Europe, certainly in the Balkans, and in Africa, for that matter, tends to suggest that we didn't predict that one correctly. We have inherited or come into a new world which has a very different kind of dynamic and very, very different problems.
Certainly the collapse of communism did not by itself produce a benign world.
I want to come to that less than totally benign world in which we now find ourselves, but before I do, there are two great events within the context of the Cold War, and you were much involved directly in the management of our response as regards one of those events. And what I have in mind are the two hot wars within the Cold War that involved us, namely the Korean War and, of course, Vietnam. How did it happen that, despite the operation of containment policy and despite the maintenance of that general stance, that we can struggle with these adversaries, raising arms levels, freezing them out where they get too unpleasant, building up the economic power of our allies as they renewed themselves? How did it happen that, despite all of that, twice communist power challenged nations that were more or less allied with us, and how did it happen that we felt called upon to come to the aid of those allied nations?
These are two separate questions. As you recognize, the first one is, why did the communists act as they did?
And the second is, why did we respond?
Why did we act? Why did we respond as we did? And each of these wars had its own specific peculiarity. In the case of Korea, the communists can be forgiven for thinking that we had told them that this was a free shot at us, because General MacArthur in early 1950 had publicly declared that Korea was outside of our defense perimeter, publicly. Dean Acheson, 3 months later, had done a similar thing. So therefore, looking at it from Pyongyang in Moscow, this looked like easy pickings. And it was the period that we were building up Europe, and the Soviet Union was building up Eastern Europe as a military alliance. So the thought must have been on the Soviet side, in encouraging it, that let's fill every crevice we can. Even if we don't want to go any further, let's grab what has clearly been indicated for us. We went in the Korean War because of our traditional approach that we don't analyze issues on the basis of national interest, but on the basis of general principles. So we said, if aggression succeeds in Korea, then it is going to become worldwide, which was not necessarily true. And
sounds rather like the domino theory, which we also employed
in
with regard to Vietnam.
It's exactly right. Yeah. And there was also an idea which was certainly not correct, that the Soviets had invented the Korean War to lure us into Asia so that they could hit us in Europe. That was certainly not correct, because Stalin, while totally ruthless and brutal, was also extremely cautious. And there's no evidence that he ever planned to occupy Europe militarily. What he wanted was to add it to the Soviet sphere by political agitation and by political combat. Now, so the Korean War, the key aspect of it was that it was not protected by the American alliance, so people couldn't count on our going in there. And that there were a number of circumstances peculiar to Korea which produced a conjunction of events on the communist side, that the North Korean leader Kim Il-sung, who's still alive and still in power, is a fanatical communist, that Stalin was willing to support him partly to maintain the Russian influence because he thought it was cheap. Vietnam had a similar characteristic. South Vietnam was not protected by an American alliance. The local communist rulers were fanatical and believers in class struggle and military action. And the Americans thought that they were defending a principle in Vietnam, principle of non-aggression and the principle of democratization. And so, gradually, through a series of administration, we slid into it.
Vietnam is yet another matter. We've got some commercials that are overdue, I fear. When we come back, I'd like to talk with you about Vietnam. As I say, by the point, not at the beginning of that war, but by the time the Nixon administration comes into power and you come to Washington, you become one of the policy makers with regard to this very important aspect of American foreign affairs. And from that, we'll work our way towards something I signaled earlier, namely an examination of the collapse of communism and the consequence in terms of the world we face at the moment and the policy dilemmas that are being examined every day, undoubtedly, in the State Department, just as they are being examined back at your old haunts in the international relations sectors of Harvard University. We'll return directly to Henry Kissinger, whose new book is Diplomacy, published by Simon & Schuster. First, these words. We return to former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, for some years now, the head of your firm is called Kissinger Associates, is it not?
Right, yes.
Which advises governments and corporate organizations around
not
the world.
Not governments. We don't take any...
Not governments at all.
We take no public money from anybody.
I stand properly corrected, then. Let us come to the Vietnam War. One of the real surprises for me in this book, though I shouldn't be totally surprised, you've got a number of chapters, of course, which deal with how we initially got drawn in, the troubles we ran into, how you were involved with Lee Duc Tho, your opposite number in the Paris, and ultimately how during the Ford administration we extricated ourselves from Vietnam. And it was for those negotiations that you and Lee Duc Tho both won the Nobel Prize, as I remember. But I find you offering the overall judgment that this was that our involvement in that war was a disaster, and I think what you're saying is, all in all, it would have been far better if we had never been drawn in, or if we had resisted the lure to go in.
The end of the war was a disaster. The last 5 years of the war were a disaster in the sense that it tore the American society apart and it did not know how to deal with it. So, obviously, it would have been better if this disaster had been avoided. But in Greek tragedy, the hero moves inevitable step after upon inevitable step to a foreordained fate.
Because of his
even
hubris.
When he knows that it's gonna...
Because of his o'erweening pride, which moved him against all his higher judgment and better judgment, moved him in the direction of claiming more in terms of power or more in terms of wisdom than indeed he had a right to claim.
Yeah, but that was our problem. It wasn't overweening pride so much. It was overweening self-confidence, yes, in a way, yeah. I guess you could say pride. I think we went into Vietnam in the Truman and Eisenhower administrations and in the Kennedy administration for the absolutely best of reasons. We thought we were practicing containment. Being Wilsonians, we could not accept the proposition that you can make a distinction between countries on the basis of importance to the United States or unimportance to the United States. As somebody practicing European style of geopolitics...
You mean we were committed to serving the good internationally at whatever cost to ourselves, without any necessary advantage to ourselves?
Without any necessary advantage to the United States. Yeah. A historic diplomatic analysis would say, how important is this country? We said, how important is this principle? This is what got us in to begin with. Then there was containment, was an opportunity to stop communism. Then there was the belief that if you can make a society democratic, that you have a great step, made a great step forward towards peace. This is what got us in. And that was probably inevitable. And strangely enough, I didn't really deal, even though I at that time was a professor at Harvard and with some reputation, I never took a particular stand on Vietnam, except that the more we committed ourselves, the more I felt that the catastrophe of defeat was too great, and therefore I wanted what was called an honorable outcome. The disaster was not that we got in. The disaster was that we couldn't find a way out and that we could not find an intellectual approach to the problem.
When, all the same, you found a kind of way out, that is the peace negotiated with North Vietnam, and those Paris Accords, and when and thus we began our withdrawal, was it the general shared expectation in high policy councils in Washington or in the Western world that the inevitable outcome of all of this would be that South Vietnam would be overrun by the communist forces from North Vietnam, that we had only bought a year or two of time for our allies?
Absolutely not. And if you think about it, it isn't even a great sign of moral stature that that wasn't our view. Because after all, we had suffered for 4 years.
Yes,
we had been harassed, reviled. We had kept what we thought our honor afloat against the strongest opposition.
And at a very high cost, even domestically. The nation was fractured by all this.
But then to say we did it only to gain a year or two is absurd.
Yeah.
We sincerely believed. Well, first of all, you have to remember the circumstances in which these negotiations were taking place. We were often told, look, De Gaulle got out of Algeria, so you can get out of Vietnam. Well, it took De Gaulle 5 years to get out of Algeria, and we got out even somewhat faster out of Vietnam, but there was one big difference between the position of De Gaulle and of Nixon. The opposition to De Gaulle wanted to accelerate the war in Vietnam, in Algeria. So therefore, the opponents of De Gaulle in Algeria, the guerrilla fighters, had every incentive to keep De Gaulle in play because the alternative would be worse. We were in exactly the opposite position. All the critics of the Vietnam War just wanted to get out. They didn't care how we got out. So that any attempt to define precise terms was obviously opposed by the Vietnamese, but also opposed by the Americans. After all of this, we finally achieved what we had set out to do, not brilliant terms, but what we thought were tolerable terms, and then our domestic tragedy started all over again.
Our domestic tragedy, to what do you refer exactly?
Well, the first tragedy was Vietnam.
Yeah.
At the divisions of Vietnam. The second one was Watergate.
Ah. Uh-huh. And you think without the collapse of the Nixon administration in the Watergate drama, things might have turned out differently in Southeast Asia?
Without the collapse of Nixon and Watergate, Vietnam would certainly not have fallen in 1975 while Nixon was still in office.
Mm-hmm.
And I think so many things would have been different that it is highly unlikely that the Vietnamese would have attacked in 75 or would have won in 75.
In other words, in Hanoi, the calculation was they're so distracted and Nixon is in so much trouble that they can't go on mining distant store.
Well, one of the direct results of Watergate was that the Congress passed a law prohibiting any military action in, over, or near Indochina.
Mm-hmm.
That meant that we had lost the stick.
Yeah.
Then the Congress wouldn't pass economic aid, so we'd lost the carrot.
There's so much we could be talking about tonight, and there's so much, and I'm fascinated but inevitably frustrated because there are a thousand other questions I'd like to put to you, but one that comes naturally in sequence at this moment, though I still have in mind coming to the present international situation, and we will do that
you
before...
You keep threatening me.
I do, don't I?
Yeah.
But
hold it over my head.
We've just been talking about Richard Nixon, and of course we are aware of the very desperate decline in his health, which has occurred only over the last few days. There is a section in your book in which you give an overall evaluation of Nixon, the man, and the interaction between his personality and the demands of his presidency. After some commercials, which we must take care of, once again, I'd like to ask you to read just a few paragraphs from the book, the ones I've just signaled. We'll be directly back to Henry Kissinger after these words. It is my aspiration in this continuing conversation with Henry Kissinger to get to the telephones at around 10:30. But until then, and I will say that we're opening the lines right now, the number as ever is 591 7200-591-7200. But there's still much ground to cover. And we can't cover all of it, obviously. But one thing that interested me so much was your evaluation of the man Nixon in the presidential role. And there is that passage in one of the chapters towards the in the latter third of your book, which I wish you would share with us.
Of course, the listener will understand that this was written with a healthy Nixon.
To be sure.
And although it's very favorable to him. Richard Milhouse Nixon had inherited near-Civil War conditions. Deeply suspicious of the establishment, he nevertheless held fast to the conviction that the world's leading democracy could neither abdicate its responsibility nor resign from its destiny. Few presidents have been as complex as Nixon. Shy, yet determined. Insecure, yet resolute. Distrustful of intellectuals, yet privately, deeply reflective. Sometimes okay, impetuous in his pronouncements, yet far-sighted and patient in his strategic design. Nixon found himself in the position of having to guide America through the transition from dominance to leadership. Often harsh in his pronouncements, Nixon nevertheless fulfilled, under the most difficult circumstances, the crucial test of leadership, which is to move his society from where it was to where it had never been. No American president possessed a greater knowledge of international affairs. None except Theodore Roosevelt had traveled as much abroad or attempted with such genuine interest to understand the views of other leaders. Nixon was not a student of history in the same way that Churchill or de Gaulle had been. He generally learned just enough about a country to absorb the rudiments of the facts pertaining to its circumstances. Yet, he had an uncanny ability to grasp the political dynamics of any country, and his understanding of the geopolitical realities was truly remarkable. Nixon's handling of domestic politics could at times be distorted by ambition and personal insecurity. But when it came to foreign policy, his powerful analytical skills and extraordinary geopolitical intuition were always crisply focused on the American interest. Nixon did not accept the Wilsonian verities about the essential goodness of man or the underlying harmony among nations to be maintained by collective security. Wilson had perceived the world progressing inexorably towards peace and democracy. America's mission was to help the inevitable along. For Nixon, the world was divided between friends and antagonists, between arenas for cooperation and those in which interests clashed. In Nixon's perception, peace and harmony were not the natural order of things, but temporary oases in a perilous world where stability needed to be preserved by vigilance and effort. Nixon sought to navigate according to a concept of America's national interest. Repugnant as that idea was to many traditional idealists, if the major powers, including the United States, pursued their interests rationally and predictably, Nixon believed in the spirit of the 18th century Enlightenment that an equilibrium would emerge from the clash of competing interests. Like Theodore Roosevelt, but unlike any other 20th century president, Nixon counted on the balance of power to produce stability and considered a strong America essential to the global equilibrium.
It's a very positive evaluation. At the same time, it takes into account the idiosyncrasies of the man. At a time like this, that is this moment, when he is in considerable physical distress, indeed doesn't have full control of his faculties and one doesn't know what his future will be, one wants to speak only good of him. Yet there is the tragic side to his presidential career. I won't ask you to interpret Watergate and whether it was inevitable, but you've already indicated that you thought it did throw our foreign policy into a kind of rupture, which gave advantage, I would imagine, not only to the North Vietnamese, but to many others who were in adversarial relationship to us.
Everybody. Including the Soviets.
Yeah. As you describe his general foreign policy orientation, how does it coincide with your, in that passage you've just read, how does it coincide with your own? Where would you, if at all, disagree with his general foreign affairs philosophy?
You know, Nixon and I were a strange pair.
That's been observed by Woodward and Bernstein, among others.
Yeah, but they didn't know what they were talking about because they didn't know Nixon very well, yeah. Or they didn't know me very well. But it's true. Strange in this sense. I came from the Rockefeller camp. Nixon had been anathema to me all of my political career. Nixon came from the extreme conservative camp. I came from the liberal Republican camp. So he is a Quaker. I'm Jewish. So there were very few areas where he came from a poor family. We were also very poor when we came to this country, but I went to Harvard, and he felt himself an outcast in society, and I never did. Nevertheless, and we never met before he became president, once for 3 minutes, but we never had a serious conversation until he had been elected. And nevertheless, on most issues, I would say on 98% of the issues, we saw eye to eye. He had a more political approach. I had a more conceptual approach. He had an approach to decision-making from which I learned a lot. As an academic, I could always see that any tough decision is 51-49. So I try to hedge for this 49% when I made a recommendation. I learned from Nixon from the following sentence that Nixon always used, which was, you pay the same price for doing something halfway as for doing it completely. So you might as well do it completely. You do not ease the pressure on yourself by doing it halfway. And there's a lot of truth in this. So we turned out to be a well-matched team, even in the absence of intense social contact. And that didn't matter much with Nixon anyway, because he didn't like social contact with anybody. His essence was expressed in working, and we worked a lot together. And it was a very fruitful and positive relationship.
I must jump forward to the present moment. That is to say, the world as it is now, and perhaps the problems faced by the present administration and by the present Secretary of State and our whole foreign policy establishment, as well as the foreign policy establishments of our closest allied friendly nations in Europe and elsewhere. So at last, what is the best way to perceive and to comprehend this new world order? You know, I've always been bothered by the use of that term. I think Bush first began to use it, and it reminds me of the Nazi Neues Weltordnung, which I don't quite like.
I'm bothered by the way Bush used the term, because he implied that it was already here.
Yes.
And in a way that he had helped create it with the Gulf War. And the fact is, the old world order has collapsed. A new world is emerging, but it isn't here yet.
We don't yet fully know its shape, do you feel?
No, we know the problems that it produces. Mm-hmm. And we should know, although we haven't understood it fully yet, that it makes demands on us which are really quite different from our historical experience.
Well, one very basic point you make it even in the first chapter, and it recurs at appropriate points throughout the book, is that for a long time, the world order in which we struggled against communist power was one in which we indeed organized a good part of the world, and we were the dominant power.
Correct.
But we no longer are that, or we shortly will no longer be.
Well, we are the strongest, but we are now more or less one among several.
And we enter into a world in which balance of power considerations need to become important to us, and we need to live in those terms, whereas for a long time we didn't have to.
Well, the balance of power emerges, as we said earlier, when you have states that are more or less evenly matched.
Yeah.
So for the first time in our history, we should look at balance of power considerations. We are always told we are the only superpower, but when you go to Bosnia, Somalia, indeed you go to any problem that exists in the world today, our kind of military power, it's not really relevant to most of these issues.
We seem to be a sort of powerless superpower.
Not powerless, but we are not all powerful.
Ineffectual, certainly.
We are ineffectual in part because this sounds unkind, but we don't know what we are doing. And we don't know what we are doing because the concepts which we inherited no longer apply to the present situation, so that what we have to do is to develop an approach to the contemporary world.
Well, what glimmerings do you have as to what direction that approach might go?
Well, we have to recognize that there are 5, 6, 7 major power centers. And therefore, we have to analyze which... And therefore, we cannot do everything simultaneously. So we have to analyze what goals are fundamental, which are subsidiary, and which are out of reach. We have to know what price we're willing to pay for all of the for any of these, and develop a strategy or diplomacy to achieve them. As a general proposition, we have to ask ourselves relations with Europe, relations. Let me illustrate it best in Asia, because, or in relations with the former Soviet Union. In Asia, we have China, Japan, Russia, India. What does it mean to have a balance of power approach there? What it means is that, ideally, if we can achieve it, we should have better relations with each of them than they have with each other. Greater options to achieve than they have to each other, because then we can move our weight in the direction that is most conducive to stability and to progress. We don't look at it this way, because if we looked at it this way, we wouldn't have a fight going on with Japan and China simultaneously, thereby having fewer options towards each of them than they have to each other. With respect to that huge area between Vladivostok and the German border, we have somehow to look at it as a geostrategic problem, which we never have. We have had the belief, as a result of containment and past history, that once communism disappeared from Russia, everything would solve itself automatically. Now we find that ethnic conflicts in Eastern Europe are more intense than they have been in a long time.
That's been the most bitter surprise. Maybe it shouldn't have been a surprise, but it has overwhelmed us.
It's a huge surprise. Then we find in Bosnia that unintentionally we are recreating the pattern of pre-World War I with Russia on one side, the West on others, and that the issue is of no consequence to either side. Bismarck, in the late 19th century, not only said it isn't worth the bone of a Prussian grenadier, which is renowned, but he also said we must not get involved in the lusts and passions of the sheep stealers in the Balkans. Now, it's a brutal thing to say, but we are getting involved in the passions of the Balkans.
But the old American principle, the moral concern for the welfare of the rest of the world, would suggest we Wilson would have wanted us to be involved, would he not?
Yes, but then the question is, what price are you willing to pay? And we saw in Somalia, we went in with forces, we had 18 casualties, and we quit because the American people did not perceive that in Somalia anything was at stake that affected them directly. I'm a student of foreign policy. I had never heard of Gurazzi until 2 weeks ago. So it must be a very low priority in strategic considerations. But this is a special case. Then you have the problem of Poland, which is a historic problem. They're scared to death of Russia. They want to enter NATO. So the United States says, you can't enter NATO except in company with Russia. Well, this is asking the sheep to be protected by the wolf. And therefore, my view is that in the world that is emerging, the United States have to learn to understand with realities that are not ideologically defined as in the past, that cannot be encompassed entirely in legal frameworks. And that is the big challenge before this administration or its successors.
Do I understand this correctly? Do I translate it correctly? That what you're really suggesting is that the overall aspiration should be to build a new international league of Uncle Sam and his friends?
No.
Wherever we find those friends.
No, we have to be in a position where we befriend those who can serve our national interests. And for this, we should always have options towards this maximum range of nations.
Come back to the example you're just giving. I gather you were saying we should be friendly towards Poland and get them into NATO without a Soviet partner. How does doing that, and how does our getting that close to Poland serve our national interests?
The historic Russian problem. I think Russia has died of indigestion because it could never stop its the momentum of its advance. So I think it is better. And nor do I think that the basic Russian attitudes towards this have changed yet. So I think it is better to make clear to Russia what its limitations are. On the other hand, I favor giving Russia every opportunity to have good relations with the rest of the world by strengthening economic ties. I favor economic aid, cultural ties, political ties, but we must not forget that there are other elements.
Should we, by the way, considering Russia, which was for so long our major opponent in the world, that is, Russia as the core of the then Soviet Union, should we be concerned about its domestic politics? Should we be worried about Zhirinovsky and the even worse, who are also on the stage waiting for an entrance?
We should be worried about it, but we cannot do much about it.
Can't do anything about it.
Above all, we should not conduct. The other day somebody asked me, in Bosnia, should we conduct our policy to keep Zhirinovsky out of office in Moscow? I think what is confronting us now is Yeltsin, not Zhirinovsky. Zhirinovsky is Yeltsin's problem. Yeltsin is our problem. And this is not hostile to Yeltsin. It just means that we cannot determine the outcome of that struggle.
Yeah, and Yeltsin has his own constituencies to keep happy.
And after all, Yeltsin is the president who is keeping Russian troops in Azerbaijan, Georgia, Moldavia, Estonia, Latvia, and is trying to get them back into the Ukraine.
All in all, last question before we go to commercials and then on to the telephones on 591-7200. But we'll be on to your calls in just a few minutes. So I must allow myself only one more brief question. All in all, as you look at the functioning of the American foreign policy establishment these days, which means your current successor as Secretary of State and the way in which the old staff you knew and the new members of that staff at State Department, as you look at how they've been processing American foreign policy and how the President is handling such advice or such guidance as he gets from the State Department building, what's your evaluation?
First of all, we've not had a post-war president who is as uninterested in foreign policy as President Clinton is. And that then permeates
the whole. Yes, he's got a very heavy domestic agenda, surely.
Yes, but he doesn't have the choice between domestic and foreign. If he can't do both, he won't be able to do either in the long run. And he has to take some position on the issues that are described under the category of New World Order, and his basic instinct is to wait how to handle tactically crises that arise. Christopher is a good professional, but he is not a creator of strategy. Right now, I'm worried about the state of American foreign policy.
Let's hope they all read your book. We will pause just briefly for a quick round of commercials and then directly onto the phones. 591-7200, the number, and directly onto your calls after these words. In our conversation tonight with Dr. Henry Kissinger, we've been drawing from his most significant new book, Diplomacy, which is, by way of being a general history of foreign affairs and foreign affairs strategic undertakings over the last 300 years. You essentially start with a piece of Westphalia, don't you?
Yes.
Which dates back to 1648.
I spent most of the time, half of the book, on the post-Cold War, the Cold War period.
We'll go directly to the phones and stay with them for the rest of the available time. Here is the first caller. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening.
Yes, sir.
It seems that the sovereign nation state is obsolete or dysfunctional. Could you please comment?
Well, it may be dysfunctional, but it isn't obsolete. Because, in fact, in the post-Cold War period, the emphasis on the nation-state and on ethnic peculiarities and particularities is becoming more dominant.
But it seems like, for example, we have John Gacy here in Illinois on the verge of execution, and yet there are worse killers than him in control of entire countries. And to me, that seems insane.
Well, certainly what is going on in a place like Rwanda, where at least 100,000 people have been killed, would indicate that what you're saying has a lot of merit.
And so what better way could we organize ourselves? Some sort of a global legal authority?
This is, you know, with all due respect, this is the old American dream, which has been impossible to apply because most of the world does not accept the proposition that you can that you should resist illegality. What they do is they resist those matters that affect their own future and their own prosperity.
We haven't yet used the term realpolitik, but of course it shows up in your book quite appropriately. And you're saying the world still lives in
the same way. I'm not saying, incidentally, that I like that sort of a world. In the 15th century, Machiavelli wrote a small book called The Prince and a larger book called Discourses. In The Prince, he described how the city-states of Italy were dealing with each other, which was pretty awful. And people said this proves that he's a very amoral character. In fact, in his Discourses, he showed he was an extremely moral character. He just described what he found. And statesmen, unfortunately, have to deal with the environment in which they live, and not only with their aspirations.
Our thanks to the caller, and let us go quickly to another. Good evening, you're on the air.
Good evening, Milt.
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Dr. Kissinger. It's a real honor to be able to speak with you.
Thank you. Pleasure to hear you.
Thank you. My question is, as a history teacher at the high school level, I've been interested in all my years of studying history, how George Washington's farewell address is constantly used by politicians such as Pat Buchanan and isolationist rhetoric. My question for you is, do you believe Americans are historically isolationists? And if they are, why is it that way? And how have the politicians in the last 200 years seemed to not follow, if that is the case, this isolationist mentality of Americans? Thank you.
Well, first of all, I'm of the view that the American people have never been the obstacle to foreign policy. The American intellectuals have sometimes been, the media have sometimes been, the Congress has sometimes been, But I don't think that the American people have ever resisted a strong leadership from the White House. Now, Washington's farewell address has been interpreted to suit the preferences of the interpreter. You have Pat Buchanan, but you also have Woodrow Wilson, who interpreted the farewell address to mean that America was obliged to spread democracy, and that what the farewell address said was that we should not be connected with non-democratic states. Be that as it may, the isolationist impulse reflected the realities of the 19th century. In the 20th century, we have not been able to stay isolationist, certainly not after World War II, and in the world in which we are today, every succeeding president, no matter what he said in the campaign, has found that America has to be involved, and it is not really our choice, it's our necessity.
Thank you, Dr. Kissinger.
Thank you, sir, for the call. And quickly on to another. Good evening, you're on the air.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kissinger. It's an honor to speak to you. I think you're probably one of the best Secretary of States, if not the best Secretary of State this country ever had.
Thank you.
I would like to ask you about the Middle East. I don't think there's anybody in American diplomacy that knows the Middle East better than you do. And you dealt very fairly with the Arabs. You dealt very fairly with the Israelis when you were Secretary of State. My question to you is this, sir. Do you think it is possible to have a lasting peace between Israel and its Arab neighbors?
I think it is possible to have a very prolonged coexistence between Israel and the Arab neighbors. I make that distinction because sometimes the impression is created that it is a document that has the word peace written on it that will produce peace. The real problem on the West Bank is, which is the key issue on the West Bank of Palestine, is that Israel and the Arabs are forced to live together, but they have not yet learned to coexist with each other. I think the outline of the agreement that was made last year, with all its weaknesses, once it is implemented, can create the basis for a possible coexistence.
Can I ask you one other fast question?
Please.
Why, in your opinion, do you think President Bush did not take out Saddam Hussein when they had the opportunity to do so?
It's a good question, because the United States, as a general proposition, does not have a geostrategic view. We came in to prevent the occupation of Kuwait by Iraq. We achieved the liberation of Kuwait, and therefore we did not analyze adequately what would happen if Saddam Hussein survived, which really takes Iraq out of the politics of the Middle East and makes Iran disproportionately strong. I think in retrospect it was a mistake. If we had gone on two or three more days, Saddam would almost certainly have been overthrown.
I had occasion to put that same question to George Shultz only a few months ago. What did he say? Well, though he doesn't say this in his recent book, or doesn't say it as clearly, I thought he was essentially saying the same thing that you've just said, but
in simpler language.
Not simpler, but perhaps a little bit more veiled. But I thought that essentially the view was essentially...
I think that's right. He's a good friend of mine, yeah. And he has very similar views.
I'm particularly glad we had that last question because of its reference to the Middle East, because we have not discussed those matters at all so far tonight. And there is, of course, a very interesting section of the new book, Diplomacy, dealing with our involvement in Middle Eastern diplomacy. You, of course, exhausted yourself for quite a while in what was then, in the journalistic phrase, called shuttle diplomacy.
Yeah, but it was also an exciting period.
I'm sure it was.
And I had the great good fortune of working with President Sadat, who made all the Americans who dealt with him look good, because he was a man of extraordinary courage and vision. And, he would take big jumps, and he understood that the problem between Arabs and Israelis was primarily psychological. and that his contribution should be to remove the psychological, to ease the psychological framework.
Before we go to a last batch of commercials, a little a conundrum for you. Do you know, do you remember which novel, a sort of roman à clé by two well-known American journalists, broadcasters, I guess both of them, features you as in the middle of Middle East negotiations while a mystery of a more personal sort unfolds?
Yeah, isn't Ted Koppel one of them?
Koppel and Kalb.
And Kalb.
And Marvin Kalb.
Yeah, I knew Koppel was one of them.
Yeah, they were here.
He was, they were colleagues of mine.
I know.
During shuttle diplomacy.
I know. Yeah.
They were on my plane, and they were second-guessing me every night.
And they then imagined that book and had a lot of fun with it, and they were here many years ago when that book was just published. A last batch of commercials, and then directly back to additional calls for Henry Kissinger on 591-7200. And directly and quickly back to Henry Kissinger, and we'll work in as many calls as we can in the next 10 minutes. Here's the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, Dr. Kissinger, I had the pleasure of listening to a speech you gave in 1981 out here in Rockford, Illinois. And
I remember that occasion.
Well, I certainly do, too. I asked you a question then about what we in the world should do about Omar Gaddafi, and I'd be interested...
I hope I said something sensible.
And I'd be interested to, in your opinion, tonight on the history and effectiveness of economic sanctions against aggressive dictators and militaristic nations. I'm thinking of Saddam Hussein and the Serbs and other nations. I'm just wondering what you think of it.
I don't know any example in which economic sanctions have worked against aggression, unless you say South Africa, but that wasn't a case of aggression. But I cannot think of one example where economic sanctions have worked.
So you don't think it's an effective tool of foreign policy?
No, I think it's an effective tool of foreign policy in conjunction with other things to achieve objectives that are somewhat short of the most vital national objectives. Because for the most vital ones, you have to take other and stronger measures.
What about the case of most favored nation status with China? How does that fall into that concept of sanctions?
Well, in my view, we should apply economic sanctions only on matters that fundamentally affect our perception of our national security. In China, we have the problem that we have legitimate complaints on human rights, but we also have the problem that this is the fastest growing economy in the world, and to exclude ourselves from it when no other nation in the world will go along with us means only to put ourselves at a disadvantage. And above all, you cannot imagine peace in Asia without the cooperation of China, which has the largest population, the longest history, the greatest impact on the others.
Sir, I thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Very glad to have heard from you, and here is another. Good evening, you're on the air.
Good evening, and this is a great honor. I was wondering if I could speak to Dr. Kissinger and get his input on something, and this is involving Mr. Nixon's penchant for secrecy. Thinking about the bombing of Cambodia in 1970 and also the conflict between India and Pakistan. Certainly in our history there have been people like Jefferson with the Louisiana Purchase and Theodore Roosevelt with the Panama Canal where they've acted without congressional consent. But Mr. Nixon had been criticized for having a hidden hand type of diplomacy. Maybe he'd learned that from Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles, I'm not sure. But he didn't really go in for a lot of congressional debate and not a lot of briefings with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Could you expand on that, please?
Well, let me tell you the background on each of these. First, on Cambodia. You have to remember, when Nixon came into office on January 20th, 1969, within 2 weeks, the Vietnamese had launched an attack in which we had 400 dead a week. Week after week, 400 dead and at least an equal number wounded. At the same time, President Johnson had stopped bombing of the North. So Nixon was looking for some reaction that would reduce the Vietnamese willingness to continue the operations. Now, along the border of South Vietnam with Cambodia, there were a series of sanctuaries, 5 miles deep, in which there were four North Vietnamese divisions that would come into South Vietnam, kill Americans, and then withdraw into the sanctuaries. So Nixon ordered the bombing of those sanctuaries where there were four North Vietnamese divisions and no Cambodian civilians at all. When we did this, our original idea was that somebody would certainly protest. We would then ask for a UN investigation. They would find the camps, and then we would say the camps have to be moved out or we will resume bombing. As it turned out, nobody protested.
But so, as far as Senate debate and congressional...
No, wait a minute. I'll get to the congressional debate. So we dealt with it as a covert operation, and we briefed the Senate committees and the House committees that dealt with foreign... with covert operations, and about 30 senators and congressmen were briefed about this, which was the way secret operations were generally conducted. And so it was not a fact that this was hidden from anybody. We did not want to claim the right to bomb a country and then be asked when that country's president or king was acquiescing in it. Now, on the India-Pakistan issue, I don't know to what secret actions you could refer to. Our problem was that within several months of Pakistan having opened up our contact with China, and before President Nixon even had had an opportunity to visit China, India, backed by the Soviet Union, was going to war with Pakistan over the issue of East Pakistan, and we wanted to show enough support for Pakistan so that we could at least get to China, and so that it did not look as if the country that had facilitated our entry moved towards China would be left totally in the lurch by the United States. But all of this was done openly. I can't think of anything that was done secretly. And we certainly took a terrific battering publicly.
One final question, and that is the impact of the Boland Amendment and how that will impact executive action in the future in determining foreign policy.
Well, let me make a point here. The Boland Amendment, which had to do with Central America and with arming the Contras in Central America, there are two aspects to keep in mind about this. One is... the Boland Amendment was sometimes in force and sometimes not in force. And this is a temptation for executive evasions. When the Congress wants to legislate on a foreign policy matter, which it should do very sparingly, but if it does it, it should do so in a definitive way so that you know what the regulations are and not change them constantly. And the second thing is that the Congress developed a really extraordinary ability to come forward with amendments that you cannot quite carry out, but that nevertheless make them not responsible for the consequences.
Still, the transgressor of the Boland Amendment, or one of them, Colonel North, just might arrive in the Senate shortly.
Yes, that doesn't mean, though, that I approve the things that Colonel North did.
I'm sure you don't.
You can't sell government property to finance your own war.
We are almost out of time. As you look back on your public career as National Security Advisor and as Secretary of State, and of course those two overlapped for about 2 years, didn't they?
Correct.
Is there any day you'd like to go back and live over and change?
Well, to me the most painful day was when I had to announce the withdrawal from Saigon.
Uh-huh.
But it isn't anything that I could have changed. You know, when you answer a question like this, you sound terribly arrogant when you say you can't think of anything you'd do differently. But the fact is, when you are at these high levels, you get these problems that are 51-49. They're extremely painful to deal with. You've done the best you could with them, and while that may not be good enough, you probably won't change your mind over a period of years.
And I would add, you've also done the best you could in writing what I take to be the ultimate volume, though probably there will yet be others to come, in your career as a writer. Diplomacy by Henry Kissinger, just published by Simon & Schuster, is, I think, a work that will live for a long time and will undoubtedly have great utility in structuring our study of foreign affairs and foreign relations.
Thank you.
Not merely the art of diplomacy, but rather the nature of the relations between states.
Thank you very much.
I thank you most sincerely for joining us. It's been an exceptionally interesting evening.